Well, good morning, fellow Bible scholars, Bible students. Good to have you with us on this chilly Wednesday morning. It's Ecclesiastes Day. Been a couple of weeks since we've been in the Ecclesiastes. I think we're in chapter 7. So get your Bibles open to Ecclesiastes chapter 7 as we resume our study of this fascinating book of wisdom in the Old Testament. Solomon's Book of Ecclesiastes coming right at you here on the Panic Podcast. Thanks for tuning in today. Well, as I say, it's good to have you with us, and I hope you're having a good week. What a week it has been here in Southwest Virginia. I mean, and around the world, it has just been an incredible week with all kinds of crazy things going on. Elon Musk buying Twitter. Can you believe that? I might have to actually join Twitter again. I used to be on Twitter years ago. I'm talking 20 years ago, 15 years ago, I don't know, long, long time. And I was on there mostly just to gather news, you know. And I could not figure Twitter out. There's so many things I don't understand. Like, I don't understand, like, why you're at somewhere. Like, I think my name back in the day was at Mike Porter or something like that. I don't know. That's me, by the way, Mike Porter, your online Bible study buddy. Like, why do you have to be at somewhere? Why can't you just have your own name? So I never understood that. I never understood why you're only allowed so many characters, i.e. so many words. Like, do you know how hard it is for a public speaker to just have a few words to make a post? I never understood that. And I never understood all these people that wanted to follow me, and I didn't know who they were. Bunch of weirdos. So I jumped out of Twitter like years ago. But now that Elon Musk has bought it, and he's a big free speech guy, and I'm a free speech absolutist. I think free speech is essential in a free society. And when I say absolute free speech, I mean 100% absolute free speech. You can say anything you want, but nobody is obligated to listen to you. That's the thing about free speech that works, is that you can say what you want, but nobody has to listen to you. So I might have to go back and join again just to support Elon Musk, because Lord knows he needs my support. And I woke up this morning to frost. And it was 37 degrees on the way into church this morning. I had to cover up my cacti. It was so cold. And that's why I'm in the fellowship hall recording this morning. So if you hear a bit of an echo, if it sounds like I'm in a tin can, that's why my professional podcaster's studio was like an ice box. So I thought I'd come out here and sit in front of the fire. I'm just to give you a picture of where I am. If you watch the 3 Minutes with Mike daily devotionals, and I know many of you do, thank you for that. If you get anything from those devotionals, be sure to tell others. Send them the link, Facebook link, my link on my website or on Telegram. Be sure to send it to them, and they might enjoy it too. But I'm sitting in front of that fireplace right now. It is cozy. I've got my notes in front of me, my Bible open, and a fresh brewed cup of coffee. So we are ready to study the Bible. Are you ready to study the Bible? We're in Ecclesiastes, as I say, and we're getting close to the end. Wednesday nights at church, I think I've got 2 more weeks left, and then that'll be it. And if you're in the area, be sure to stop in. Love to have you visit with us Wednesday night, 6 o'clock. Church is in Norton, 1230 Church Street, Norton, Virginia. Norton is the name of a town. Well, it's a village. It's a Freudian slip there. It's a city Somehow, decades and decades ago, Norton became a city, and I think you've got to have, what is it, 5,000, population of 5,000 to be designated as a city. Somewhere they dug up 5,000 people, so Norton is a city. And I made the mistake when I first moved down here about 22 years ago. I referred to the area as the Tri-Towns, because we've got Coburn, which is where I live, and Wise, which is a town just down the highway from where I live, and Norton, the quote-unquote city, just down the other way, the other direction on the highway. And I referred to it as the Tri-Towns, and I was soundly trounced because Norton is a city. So if you're in the area of the city of Norton, as I say, we're at 1230 Church Street, Northwest. Okay, Ecclesiastes chapter 7. Kyle and Dillich, in their famous commentary on the Old Testament, call chapter 7 of Ecclesiastes, are you ready for this? This is their subtitle. Proverbs of better things, things supposed to be better, good things, good and bad days. it's long, but it's a clever and apt title for the first 14 verses of this great chapter. So let's get started. Ecclesiastes 7, verse 1. Solomon writes, "A good name is better than fine perfume, and the day of death better than the day of birth." Interesting, isn't it? What does a good name mean? What do you think a good name means? Some people would say it refers to one's reputation, but it actually means far more than just a person's reputation, because a reputation can be manufactured or created and may differ in the eyes of the beholder. A good name refers, in fact, to character, a godly mind and life. It refers to what a person is in the eyes of God, with whom the name and the reality are one and the same. This is good. So a good name is good. Everything else is vanity or meaningless. Now, if you just hold your place here in Ecclesiastes and go back to Proverbs 22, we have kind of a parallel thought expressed in the first verse, Proverbs 22, verse 1. A good name, there's that phrase, a good name is more desirable than great riches. To be esteemed is better than silver or gold. Now, fine perfume is a more modern way to speak of precious ointment. And that would have been extremely expensive and lavish, used lavishly at costly banquets in the richest homes, okay? So a good name is more desirable than great riches. To be esteemed is better than silver or gold, or a good name is better than fine perfume, or, you know, precious ointment, as some translations put it. The Hebrew word for name and for ointment or perfume, depending on your translation, it forms a humorous pun that you don't see in translation. The words in the Hebrew are shim and shemen. So the pun becomes, quote, to become a good odor. So one who has found favor in God's eyes smells good. One who's found favor in God's eyes is one whose life goes beyond a sweet scent, in other words. But how is the day of death better than the day of birth? Okay, this is definitely one of those curious thoughts that pop up so frequently in the book of Ecclesiastes, but you know, it's just a proverb, which means you don't take it literally. You have to take the meaning of the proverb literally. Like in no world, not even bizarro world, is it better to be dead than alive, okay? Or better to die than to be born. So what is the meaning of the proverb, the day of death better than the day of birth? What is the meaning? Well, it probably goes something like this. It's better to attend a funeral than to attend a birthday party. Clear as mud, right? It's better to attend a funeral than to attend a birthday party. What in the world does that mean, Mike? Well, I'm glad you asked. Let's read the second verse, and maybe that'll shed some light on the first verse. Ecclesiastes 7:2. It's better to go to a house of mourning. Okay, there's your funeral. It's better to go to a house of mourning than to go to a house of feasting. Better to go to a birthday party. For death is the destiny of everyone. The living should take this to heart. Death is the end of all people. I know that's a shocking statement, and I don't mean to depress you on such a beautiful sunny day, but you're going to die. Every one of you listening to this podcast, every one of you will die. I hope not before the end of the podcast. I hope you get to hear the whole thing. But death is the end of all people. It's the one experience common to every single human being ever born. And this fact puts a right perspective on many decisions, for example. So the living should pay proper attention to the fact that they will die. People today go to great lengths to avoid sorrow, even to the point of not even talking about death. Have you ever tried to talk about death to somebody? I remember, gosh, it's got to be, over 25 years ago. Oh, more than that, 30 years ago. A friend of mine, when I was a struggling young preacher, came and you know, everybody knew I was short of cash back in the day, and he said, "Why don't you come to work part-time for me?" It's even as I say this, I crack myself up, selling life insurance. So I did. I studied the life insurance course for the province of Ontario and passed it, of course. Got my license and commenced to sell life insurance. I was a terrible salesman. I mean, can you imagine me sitting across the table from you, saying something like, "Boy, have I got a deal for you." I was terrible at it. And because a visit from me would depress anybody because, of course, why do you buy life insurance? You buy life insurance because you're going to die. So being a preacher, of course, I would spend my half hour with you talking about your impending doom. So I didn't sell a lot of life insurance. I sold some, but I didn't sell very much. And I admire anybody that can peddle life insurance. Everybody needs it, by the way, but boy, it's a hard thing to sell. So people today go to great lengths to avoid sorrow. As I say, even to the point of avoiding just talking about death. I mean, how many of you have been to funeral services? The reality of a funeral service, the reality. What is the reality of a funeral service? Well, there's if the coffin is there and it's open, there's a corpse lying in a coffin at the front of the church or the front of the chapel in the funeral home. And that's the reality of the funeral service. But that's covered up with gorgeous flowers and beautiful soft music and a clergyman who says a lot of nice things and easy things to listen to. And when it's all over, people go home and say things like, "My, that was a nice funeral," completely forgetting the grim reality of why you were there in the first place, because of the corpse in the box at the front of the church. "Oh, he looks so good. He looked better in that box than he did when he was alive." I mean, you hear all kinds of ridiculous things spoken at a funeral. So we don't like to talk about it. We don't like to talk about it. Now, that's why it's better to attend a funeral, because eventually you're going to die. And it's a good idea to face that reality. And I mean, the reality is God wants you to think about death. Don't dwell on it. Don't be depressed about it. And in one sense, it's a blessing from God that we don't know when we're going to die. Because if we knew when we were going to die, that's probably all we'd think about. We'd never get anything done, and we'd be totally depressed all the time. So it's a blessing that we don't know when we're going to die. And in a sense, too, it's a blessing that we don't dwell on that fact all the time. But the truth of the matter is you need to think about the fact that you are going to die so you can make sure that you live right. I mean, die right. How you face death is as important as how you live your life, because that's the last testimony you have to the living. Think about that. If you're a Christian, the very last testimony you can give is how you die. Are you going to lie there screaming in agony, in fear? If you're a child of God, supposedly, you know you're going to heaven, so why would you scream and kick if you're going to heaven? You know, it's interesting to watch. I've been at many a deathbed, unfortunately. I'm not the Grim Reaper, contrary to popular opinion, but I've been at many places, at many hospital rooms and sick rooms where the dearly departed has passed, and there is a huge difference between those who die in faith and those who don't. I mean, it is markedly different. Look, I know nobody wants to go through the death experience. It's not something I'm looking forward to. But, I mean, if you're a child of God, then you know where you're going. And there's no need to carry on, you know, like it's the end of the world. Because the fact is, for you, it's the beginning of the kind of life God wants you to live. You know, precious in God's sight is the death of one of his saints. That's the Proverbs say. Okay, Ecclesiastes 7:3. So think about death. Make sure that you keep that thought in your head. Don't live like you're going to live. You're never going to die. I was going to say don't like you live forever. You are going to live forever, but don't live like you're never going to die. Frustration is better than laughter, because a sad face is good for the heart. I guess Solomon was having a bad day when he wrote chapter 3. What do you think? This third verse seems a bit out of place, but that's because some modern translations, like the one I'm using, the TNIV, choose to translate the Hebrew word for sorrow as frustration. The original word describes the vexation and anger that often accompanies grief. Now, frustration is a good translation, but it robs the verse of its obvious connection to what preceded it and follows it. So sorrow is a far better schoolmaster than laughter, which can function like a narcotic that dulls the pain of reality and blocks the process of reflection and meditation that improves our ability to think things through and make sound choices. Both thinking and choosing are sometimes tasks of the heart, as the Hebrews of old understood it. The fourth verse continues this sobering thought. The heart of the wise is in the house of mourning, the funeral. But the heart of fools is in the house of pleasure, the birthday party. The thought is simply one of balance, okay? The joy of life must not be all riot and tumult, but joy tempered with seriousness. In other words, you can't laugh all the time. Only a fool thinks the good times will never come to an end. The wise person understands this and understands there is a time to be in the house of mourning. The foolish person, on the other hand, wants to avoid the house of mourning at all costs and so that they can remain in the house of pleasure. But the man whose heart is true understands that when the time for mourning comes, there is value in participating in it, knowing that his heart will remain true. The fool thinks that the pleasures of the world are what makes him happy and makes him feel good. That may be true for a while, but those things are temporary, and you're a fool to think otherwise. It's better to face the reality of the world, where you will encounter joy and you will encounter sadness, happiness and trials with amazing regularity. So it's better to face that than to avoid it. Verses 5 and 6, let's carry on. It's better to heed the rebuke of a wise person than to listen to the song of fools. Like the crackling of thorns under the pot, so is the laughter of fools. This too is meaningless. Well, essentially, what the preacher is getting to here is that advice is always a good thing, but only if it's good advice. How many of you have ever been given bad advice? Yeah, me too. I mean, just, you know, and it takes a little bit of wisdom to discern between the two sometimes. So we should be able to discern between advice that will help us and useless advice that will either hurt us or at the very least not do us any good. We should always listen to dependable advisors, people that we respect, you know, even when their counsel hurts. Because good advice often masquerades as a hurtful rebuke that, let's face it, may wound us for a while, but that rebuke of a wise person will set us straight if we're paying attention. The Song of Fools, Solomon could be referring to flattery, you know, that feels better than a wise rebuke does that hurts. Or it could simply be an irresponsible opinion, regardless of what Solomon had in his head. The advice of a fool is like the crackling of thorns under the pot. Sounds really good, but that's not the food, you know. Verse 7, it's like coffee. It's like the smell of coffee. I have a good friend who loves the smell of coffee, but she can't stand to drink it, can't stand the taste. That's like what Solomon's saying here. Verse 7, extortion turns the wise into fools, and a bribe corrupts the heart. Okay, in order to understand this brilliant proverb, and it is brilliant, you've got to ask yourself, why do extortion and bribes corrupt people? That's the question. Think about it. Why do extortion and bribes corrupt people? The point of the proverb has nothing to do with extortion or bribes, but rather what things like them do to a person's ability to think clearly. In modern language, we might paraphrase Solomon's proverb like this: do not let your judgment be warped by irrelevant circumstances. Does that make sense now? Like, a person can make dreadfully wrong decisions and say the wrong things because of emotional pressures. For example, we read of this, of Moses and the children of Israel. I didn't look it up, but I wrote it down. Why didn't I look it up? Psalm 106. Have a look. Let me just get to it. Psalm 106, verses 32 and 33. Listen to this. By the waters of Meribah, they angered the Lord, and trouble came to Moses because of them, for they rebelled against the Spirit of God, and rash words came from Moses' lips. Yeah, Moses got in trouble for what he said that day. So sometimes circumstances can make a wise person do very foolish things. Pressure, stress, anger, frustration, things like that can catch the wisest person off guard. Verse 8, the end of the matter is better than its beginning, and patience is better than pride. Now that's an interesting proverb that can mean different things to different people. For some, it simply means that it's good to get to the end of a project, right? But given the preceding verses, the advice from the preacher seems to be not to make decisions on the basis of incidentals. We should be wise to make our decisions in view of basic purposes and goals without regard to early and incidental reactions. Not only should we keep our heads when making a decision, we shouldn't get impatient. Pride here probably refers to being rash because you're in a hurry. One scholar noted this, I love this, quote, "It's better to quietly await the course of an affair until its issue and not to indulge and act until then than to proceed rashly and with passionate haste and bring upon one's self its bad consequences. Yeah, that's exactly right. Don't rush into something without fully thinking it through just because you're excited about it. Don't buy that car just because you like the color. A New Testament commentary on this verse might be Romans 5:3, where Paul says, suffering produces perseverance. There may be many reasons why we grow impatient to resolve this or that, but even during periods of suffering, we should be patient. For the believer, even negative circumstances can become blessings if they are allowed to finish their course. James 1:4, let perseverance finish its work so that you may be mature and complete, not lacking in anything. That's right. Sometimes we want to end the suffering quickly, and so we do something really stupid. When it was probably God's will that we suffer a little bit longer, and if we had only suffered a little bit longer and hung in there, we would have experienced some tremendous blessing from the Lord or something. Yeah. The idea of patience continues in the next verse. Verse 9, do not be quickly provoked in your spirit, for anger resides in the lap of fools. Quickly provoked or hasty has reference to being passionate with excitement. A good example of somebody who was quickly provoked was Job. He let himself be provoked by the bad advice of his three friends, and that led him to make some very mean and incorrect comments about God and to God. He let himself become passionate with excitement, and that led him to a confrontation with God that resulted in Job being gently rebuked, but rebuked this all the same and set straight by the Lord. It is possible to get angry and not sin. Righteous indignation is okay with man and God, but generally speaking, it's only fools who lose their tempers and give in to feelings of anger. Verse 10, do not say, why were the old days better than these? For it is not wise to ask such questions. Unless you're referring to the 1980s, which was probably the best decade ever in the history of decades. Again, this admonition. Well, I like the 80s. Come on, I had hair. This admonition should be taken with regard for what Solomon has been saying all along here. Now, what has he been saying? Well, caution is better than rashness. However, it's possible to be too cautious, and that's not a good thing. Have you ever been stuck behind an overly cautious driver? You know what I'm talking about. So being cautious doesn't mean that no risks in life should ever be taken. To take no risk, to never step out with new ideas or initiate new enterprises is to live completely in the past. The old days, the old ways of thinking or doing things, were not necessarily better than the present. Sometimes moving ahead can be a good idea. A wise person doesn't complain about the times in which he is living. To peevishly complain that the good old days were in every way better than the present day is completely beneath the wise man's conduct. First of all, even if it were true, making such statements or dwelling on the past never contributes to resolving the problems of today. Moreover, nobody's got perfect recall. Can we honestly say that the way things were 2 decades ago was so much better than the way things are today? Are our memories that reliable? Solomon was nothing if not clear-eyed here. He was surely the last person to be impressed by the golden haze of the past. He's already told us that one age is pretty much like the other anyway. Ecclesiastes 1:9, what has been will be again. What has been done will be done again. There's nothing new under the sun. Well, what follows in verses 11, 12 is an unusually interesting estimate of wisdom. Listen to what he says. Wisdom, like an inheritance, is a good thing and benefits those who see the sun. Wisdom is a shelter, as money is a shelter. But the advantage of knowledge is this: wisdom preserves the life of its possessor. Now, let me read it from the Living Bible. That was the TNIV. Let me read it from the Living Bible, Ecclesiastes 7, 11, and 12. To be wise is as good as being rich. In fact, it's better. You can get anything by either wisdom or money, but being wise has many advantages. I like that. A lot of people think that a sudden windfall, like an inheritance from a rich uncle you didn't know you had — I wish I had a rich uncle that I didn't know I have — they think that that would be a godsend, that an infusion of cash right about now would solve all of our problems. But you probably noticed what Solomon did. When money comes like this, you need wisdom to use it properly. The security that wisdom can give one may be compared with the security associated with money, but wisdom is a better guarantee of a good life. Verses 13 and 14, consider what God has done. Who can straighten out what he has made crooked? When times are good, be happy. But when times are bad, consider. God has made the one as well as the other. Therefore, you cannot discover anything about your future. Well, the preacher finally gets around to mentioning God here in this section. The advice Solomon has given so far is good for any sensible person, believer and non-believer alike. But he's looking for the God-guided life that doesn't contradict the true wisdom of the ages, but rather goes beyond it. The believer must look for the hand of God. The reference to God's making crooked doesn't make a moral judgment on God. Rather, it's meant to stress his overall sovereign control over everything. In other words, there are some things in life you can't change. Some things God has deliberately made crooked. Now, this doesn't mean that we shouldn't try to make life better for us and for others, because we should. Throughout this book, Solomon writes in disgust with those people who permit any kind of oppression, for example. It's easy to blame God when things go sideways and neglect thanking him when good things come our way. As God's children, we experience both good and bad, right? That's part of the life of faith. The life of faith is accepting prosperity and adversity from God's hand, without being able to explain just how everything will be worked out for the future. The key, if you are a child of God, is to trust the Lord and just assume, because it's true, assume automatically that this bad thing that you're going through will work out for your good. That's how God works in our lives. And I've gone a little bit over long here. It's 34 minutes past the hour, so I guess we better call it quits for today. Come on back next week. We will get to Ecclesiastes chapter 8. And Friday we're back in the Gifts of the Spirit on the Panic Podcast. So be sure to come back in about 47 hours for the next Panic Podcast, where we continue our look at the gifts of the Spirit. Everybody, thank you so much for tuning in to the Panic Podcast today and on Monday and every Monday, Wednesday, and Friday. I can't tell you how much I enjoy studying the Bible with you, talking about God's Word. I love your comments and questions, which you can leave on my website in the comment section. You can do the same thing on Telegram, or you can, if you're listening to this somewhere else, you can just drop me an email at Mike, M-I-K-E, at Witzend, that's W-I-T-Z-E-N-D, .info, I-N-F-O. Like I said, I love to read your thoughts, and a lot of times I'll incorporate your thoughts into my teachings. So, love to hear from you. Anyway, go on out. It's Wednesday. It's the middle of the week. Make it a great day today. Be a blessing to everybody you come in contact with. And we'll see you again real soon. God bless you. Thanks for listening.